Okay, shall we begin? So you probably are aware that we have a test coming up next Tuesday. We handed out essay questions for that test last time. If you haven't picked up those essay questions, they're extras out in the foyer today. And so it's pretty much similar drill to what you are accustomed to by now. There will be three parts to the test. The first part will be slide identification, and you'll get a list of the architects and of the buildings, and then you'll just have to match them to the slides. The second part, and that'll be 10 images worth 2 points each, one for the architect, one for the name of the building. That's 20 points. Then there will be, in part number two, 10 multiple choice questions. Five of those will be on the book, and five of those will be on the lecture material. Each of those is worth 3 points, total of 30 points. And then the two essay questions, each of them worth 25 points. Same format as before. Let me give you a few tips for how I would suggest you study for the book. This book is a little different than the ones we've read before in that the authors are architects, and they actually use their own work as an example of what they're trying to talk about, which is a natural thing. There are three chapters in particular that are them talking about their own work. One of them is a chapter called Ours. One is the chapter on Sea Ranch. Charles Moore, Don Linden were both involved in Sea Ranch, which we looked at in class and which is given a whole chapter in there. Not only the Sea Ranch condominium building, which is discussed pretty thoroughly, but also the planning of Sea Ranch. And then there is the chapter at the very end called Epilogue, and that's about their work since the original publication of the book. That was added in one of the later printings of the book. So those three chapters, Ours, Epilogue, and Sea Ranch, would definitely pay particular attention to them. And within those chapters, try to figure out where are these guys coming from? What are their values? What are they interested in? And what are they doing in their buildings that maybe exemplifies the attitudes they're taking in the text? So that's one thing to pay attention to. A second thing is, as before, if they talk about a building in the book and it's a building we've talked about in class, that's certainly a good opportunity for a test question. So obviously Sea Ranch is something we talked about in class and they talk about in the book. We talked about Falling Water in class in the middle section of the course. They have quite a bit on Falling Water in there by Frank Lloyd Wright. There are a number of others. The University of Virginia that we looked at actually last time, they talk about the University of Virginia in the book. So where there are overlaps between buildings covered in the book and covered in class, that's a good opportunity for a test question. And then the third thing I would pay attention to is the first three chapters, those on Edgartown, Santa Barbara, and Sea Ranch, and especially in the context of what we were discussing in the lecture on humanism at a larger scale. What is it that makes a place, a community? What gives a town a sense of place as opposed to this could be anywhere, it's completely anonymous? And in particular, they're talking about that as regards Edgartown and Santa Barbara. What is it about those communities that gave them identity or a real sense of place? So those are my tips. Look at those chapters that deal with their work. Look at the buildings that overlap with what we've covered in class. And look at those three chapters at the beginning, especially the one on Edgartown and Santa Barbara that overlap with the material we talked about at Humanism at a Larger Scale. And then as far as the lectures go, by now, geez, you ought to be pretty good at this. Anytime I enumerate, there are X of these, or there are five of those, or four of those, or those are definitely things to pay attention to. you probably got a pretty good sense of where the multiple choice questions come from by now. Okay, any questions on that test? Cool. So last time we were talking about this notion of human factors as regards communication or meaning. How is it that those ideas are embodied in a building so that it actually says something to you? It gives you messages. And our Twitter card question was asking you to identify some building you know that conveys some particular meaning to you, and what is that meaning? We've got great responses. So here are a few. When I visited the Forbidden City in Beijing, the palaces conveyed a sense of grandeur, solemnity, and intimidation through indirect and abstract communication. The bright yellow tiles of the roof, the royal color, indicates the authority of the emperor. The tiny sculptures on the corners of the roof represent sons of the mythical dragon, reminding people of the status of the inhabitants. Someone else says, when I was in Washington, D.C., I visited the Vietnam War Memorial. At the time, I was too young to know what the Vietnam War was or what happened there, but it definitely communicated desolation with its vast black stone wall and so many names carved on the face of it. It certainly communicated desolation and remembrance, and even reflected your own face in the surface. That one's really cool because this person didn't even know what the Vietnam War was when they went there, so it wasn't about thinking about the Vietnam War. But even as a little kid, wow, it gave meaning. And so in a way, they learned about the Vietnam War by the memorial. There's something about desolation here and something about remembrance here. That's a very cool thing, the building teaching about this historical event. Someone else says, the stadium here on campus uses abstract communication to convey power and strength. With the structure's mighty facade, heavy vertical pillars, and exploitation of rigid concrete, an inherent feeling of the power of UT is communicated to visiting schools playing games there. Someone else says, the year I graduated, my high school put in a brand new library with many windows and a rather prestigious appearance from the outside. The rest of the school was pretty old and was mocked by this. The new library communicated to other schools in the district that we were prestigious and we were a good school too. By having the library be the visual eye candy, it communicated that our school put our academic values in the forefront. Someone else says the Texas Capitol conveys a message about its importance. The drive leading up to it, its scale, its unobstructed view, it's obvious the building is crucial. Yet the yard around it is friendly, perhaps to embody the idea of democracy. Someone else says, I always think of children's hospitals when I think of a building or interior overtly trying to send a message. The bright colors, funky shapes of linoleum, and the wall art all try to establish a message of cheer rather than fear. Someone else says, the Great Wall of China conveys the strength, sturdiness, size, and breadth of the Chinese empire that built it. It also exemplifies the length of life as expected in Buddhist beliefs. Someone else says, the church I grew up in communicates a message of importance. The stone expresses its permanence, and the high ceilings and the sanctuary make one feel like it's a special place for worship. My church was built in the 1800s, and as a kid, when I went there, I always felt like I was going to something important, a historic place with real meaning. In that same vein, someone says, my grandfather had a church. He was a pastor. It was a very traditional church, so when you walked inside, you felt a natural, uncontrollable sense of reverence. vaulted ceilings, red velvet pews, long windows that let light in, acoustics like no other, and overall, a sense of joy. So those are really good observations about a huge variety of places. I mean, the meaning can be incredibly different. The intimacy and reverence of a church, or the power and boldness and strength of a football stadium. All of those buildings conveying, just in their visual character, this powerful meaning. And sometimes meaning that would be hard to convey, maybe in words, maybe even more powerful by the fact that it's visual instead of verbal. So today we're starting a slightly different tack. We're still in human factors today, but for the next three lectures, this one and the two after Thanksgiving, we're going to be looking at how we pull some of these issues together. So we've been looking at a myriad of different issues, issues of form, issues of physical considerations, issues of human factors, but then even within human factors, issues that have to do with meaning, issues that have to do with humanism, issues that have to do with architectural determinism. And for these last three lectures, we're going to be talking more about how you pull these things together. Not just how one issue operates in a building, but how do you combine issues to make a real, rich, thorough, vibrant building. So today, we're just going to take these cluster of issues we've been looking at human factors and see how buildings exemplify more than one of those, how they use all of those to make a really strong building in terms of human factors. But maybe to be a really strong building in terms of human factors, it can't just be about architectural determinism, or it can't just be about meaning. It needs to weave all of these things together. And today, we're looking at how you weave those things together. The first building we're going to look at is one that's close by here. It's Austin Bergstrom International Airport. Probably some of you have flown in or out. How many have been through the Austin Airport? Okay, probably more than half the class. So we're going to talk about how it deals with all of the issues we talked about under human factors. So let's start with that first lecture, the designation and organization of use. And we talked about there that partly we do this as a measure of practicality. You don't want a little kid playing in the area where you're cooking or they might get burned. Well, in an airport, there's all kinds of things exactly like that. Functions that are very important that they're at the airport, but they should be separated from each other so as not to conflict. One great example of this is the security at the airport. There are some parts of the airport that are allowed to be non-secure areas. There are other parts of the airport that are absolutely essential to be secure. And then there are some parts of the airport that only a very, very few people are allowed to go there. So it's very important to designate certain uses, certain places, to organize those so that the security of the whole building works. So that certainly is one provocation for designation and organization of use. But also, man, this is a machine. This is something where people are very concerned about efficiency and convenience. How easy is it for me to get from the curb to the gate? How easy is it for me to get my luggage from point A to point B? How easy is it for me to go to the bathroom or get a magazine or get a bite to eat before I hop on my airplane? And it's a short period of time, and it's got to be efficient. It's got to be convenient. So the designation and organization of use is very important in designing the airport. In the case of this airport, it is a very, very clear diagram. And although the airport has been there for 16 years, and at this point they're actually adding on to it in two different ways, it has followed a master plan through that entire time. And the master plan has laid out how certain functions go in certain places and relate to each other. In the very most fundamental sense, there is a land side of the airport where the cars come in here and where you drop off. And then there is an air side of the airport that has to do with the interface of the airplanes. And between the land side and the air side is security. That's the space where you go through a screening in order to qualify you to get to that air side of the airport. So on the land side, you have all of the ticketing lobbies. You have the place where you pick up your luggage, the baggage claim area. You have all of those things that are non-secure. And then on the air side, you have all of the gates, all of the in sort of back of house areas, the place where all the guys load the luggage into their planes and fuel the planes and do all of those things. And then also the associated food and entertainment and things like that, shopping, that is part of, you know, waiting and getting ready to get on the airplane. So a very clear delineation of the air side and the land side of the airplane. That happens not just in plan, but also in section. The land side of the building has all the baggage claim down here, all the ticketing lobbies up there. It's actually built into the ground. It becomes very much about being on the land side of the airport architecturally. And then on the other side, there is the air side, which is about interfacing with the planes. It's got a completely different architectural character, very light, very airy, very open, almost like being outside when you're inside that big open space. So that diagram of designation and organization of uses is fundamentally telling the architects what the building is going to be like in a larger visual character as well. It's all about convenience, all of the parking out in that area here, two major entry points of the airport, one here, one here. From those entry points, you're in the ticketing lobbies there, and there you're able to see down in the baggage claim area there. So all that interface with coming and going and automobiles is right there on the land side. And then once you go through at those two points, immediately next to you are all the available bookstores and eating places and a bar and live music area and those kind of entertainment functions, so that you can go through and pick up your magazine or pick up your food and then go to the gates that are strung around like this. And still keeping that kind of convenience of those functions to the gates, so that you might want to go to the gate first, kind of make sure you're there and on time, and then go back and go to the bathroom, get your magazine, whatever you're going to do in that larger marketplace area. So designation organization of use is very, very important for convenience as well as for security in the airport. In the second lecture, we were talking about this notion of architectural determinism. Can you actually help orchestrate people's activities by the design of the building? And one of the things that is a common complaint in airports is that it's difficult to find your way around. They're kind of a rat maze. And a lot of times, the solution to that is signage. So you just put lots and lots of signs there, you know, ticketing this way and bathrooms this way and gates 10 through 37 this way. And that's one way of finding your way around. But maybe it's actually a little more relaxing, a little less stressful, if you just intuitively can find your way around in an airport. That you just negotiate it like you would a neighborhood or a place that you're more familiar with. So the idea in this building was to use elements of architectural determinism to facilitate people intuitively finding their way around in the building. So, as I said, there are kind of two major entry points. This is one of those entry points where even from the outside you look in and you can see, okay, well, there's ticketing. I know where I'm supposed to go to, you know, check in, get my boarding pass, whatever I need to do at that point. And then from those two major entry points, one at that end of the airport down here and the other one at the other end of the airport, and on either side of this big well. Once you go in there, at that point, you're able to see everything you need. From right there, you can see down to the ticketing lobby over here. You can see down to the baggage claim area here. You can see through to the shops and places to get food over here. You can see then through that area all the way to the gates beyond and where you're going for your flight. So at one point, when you walk in the door, kind of everything's right there, okay? Here I get my boarding pass. There I go through security. Later on, that's where I pick up my luggage. I can see where I can get a magazine. I can see where my gate is. All of those things are available just intuitively. You can see it. Instead of having to go through a rat maze to get to any of those, it's very visible. And the idea of that is that then it just makes people a little more relaxed. They can orient themselves more easily. And then once you get past security and you're in the main area where the gates are, again, it's intuitive. The shape of the building, that big arc with the entrances in the center of the arc, you kind of, okay, there's where the middle is, that's where you come and go, and then very easy distribution of the gates around so that you can, and all of them sort of linear through there, so you can see exactly all the lower gates are over here, all the upper gates are over there. I don't have to worry with, whoa, there's a wing that's 16 through 32, but this one is 1 through 15 over here. That it's all very logical, it's all very intuitive, and easy to find your way around in. Okay, that's on that notion of architectural determinism. We had those two lectures on humanism. One was humanism at a personal scale. How do you make places that have an intimacy, have a sense of humanity to them? And one of the things in an airport, I mean, geez, it's a huge building, right? I mean, there's a certain way in which you just could throw up your hands and say, well, it's just freaking intimidating. It's just not going to be a very humane place. And maybe we think of big airports as not being very humanistic places. But the architects here are trying to, how can we scale this down? How can we make it more intimate? How can we make it seem more personal? So instead of in that big space where, you know, you're getting access to all the gates and there are thousands of people in that room at any given time, so it's important that it be a big open space, but then it also scales down to the size of a little shop here or the size of a little bar here or even a live music performance space right here. It breaks it down into sort of more intimate, more cafe-like environments, more personal kinds of environments, even in the midst of the center of the airport. Above ticketing here, often the art is used as a way of humanizing the building. In this case, a series of murals that were done by Fidencio Duran and were planned in conjunction with the architecture to, so that you... They seamlessly became a message altogether. But in those murals, there's a Hispanic family in the backyard of their home in East Austin, and they've got their dog, and they've got their Frisbees, and they're having a picnic, and just that kind of scene and that kind of connection to everyday life in Austin is meant to give a different flavor to the airport, make it less intimidating, make it more of a humane and personal space. And that happens all the way through the airport. There are always devices that are scaling the building down. It may be the restaurants and that sort of thing. It may be the signage, these pylons that exist right there that give another scale and give other kinds of messages. It could be little cafe areas just for seating. And instead of just big floodlights from the top, but it actually seems like almost like street lights, like on a pedestrian-friendly street, like Second Street, where you'd have, you know, the scale of the street lights and the intimacy of cafe environments and outdoor eating areas that almost feels like that on the interior of the airport as well. And that all the way down to details, where in that slide on the right, I mean, obviously the handrails in a place like an airport, they have to be super durable. Some idiot's going to be clanging their luggage against them, some, you know, guy taking... I don't know, beer around from place to place, going to run a cart into it. I mean, they got to be super duper durable. So they're steel and they're built very solidly and out of, for the most part, economical steel pieces that are bolted together there. But then when it gets to the handrail, to that piece where you actually touch it, then it's not an industrial piece of steel. This is a hand-wrought piece of steel, made by a local craftsman here in Austin named Lars Stanley, so that you can actually see the craftsman's hand in beating that steel and making it more the shape of your hand and not just a cylinder or not just a rectangle, but actually a piece that interfaces with the human body a little better. So the idea is that that humanism is there on the smaller scale, but it's also there on a larger scale. And there actually are many of those things that we talked about, the eight things that make a more humane environment at a larger scale. Things like convenience and efficiency. Well, there's certainly tons of attention paid to where are the food services and how do you get them close to the gates and where are the restrooms and how are they immediately available when somebody gets off of an airplane and how are they distributed in such a way so they don't stack up. I mean, all the convenience and efficiency is very much built into the design. Also, the wide range of activities accommodated. This was one of those places where you don't normally have a live music performance stage in an airport. And when the architects first proposed it to the client, they were like, it's a freaking airport. We're not talking about a bar here. But the architect said, you know, there's something humanizing about having live music. And we in Austin are supposed to be the live music capital of the world. Shouldn't we have a place where people can just relax and listen to music? And even if you're not going to stop and listen to it, just the sense that those kinds of things can happen here, it gives a more humane sensibility to the place. So a performance stage was put in, a place for people to listen to live music, as a way of just breaking down and humanizing the scale of the airport. Many of the other things we talked about, certainly a wide range of people accommodated. Airports have everybody, rich people, poor people, old people, young people. Every ethnicity you can imagine, all of that's accommodated there and makes it more humane. There's even periodic natural relief in the slide on the right there. Even an airport, which has to be kind of paved heaven because you've got all these vehicles and airplanes and cars and buses and people all coming in, but a little bit was reserved there for some interludes of green that would just soften things up a little bit. Then many, many signs of human presence. In that green space, there are these pieces of sculpture that humanize that somewhat. On the left, again, in this art program in the airport, these actually are really cool paintings that are done on glass, and they're paintings of luggage. And this is down in the baggage claim area, so really appropriate. We've got art that deals with what the function is there, which is bags and luggage. And each of those, if you look carefully at them, the one on the right is somebody's guitar case. What a cool kind of Austin luggage thing. And in it, there are postcards from various places, and you can kind of see the personal life of this person who's traveling with their guitar. On the left, we get this hanging bag, and you can see their clothes, and you can see what things they're taking on their trip. There's this very, very personal element in the art as a way of, again, humanizing the building. So there are those things that we talked about, that humanism at a larger scale. There also is this wide variety of activities that occur there, everything from the live music scene to food to books to places you can just do your email. There also is an attempt to really embody something of the culture of Austin in the airport. And there was, in fact, a committee that the city council appointed to work with the architects to help them incorporate the nature and character of Austin. How can you make an airport that doesn't just seem like it could be anywhere, but has something of the characteristics of Austin itself? And so the architects did a number of things in that regard. One thing is sort of on the right, this sense of relaxed, laid-back, eating, music kinds of places. And they happen several places in the airport. On the left here, there are these pylons, and they're actually there for signage partly, and there's all kinds of things incorporated in that. There's the fire extinguisher is in there, and there are speakers in here, and there are all kinds of functional things that are there. But there also is this little vitrine hollowed out, this little glass display case. And that was the architect's idea of, well, we'll have different people in the community be able to explicitly communicate what this community is about. Different organizations, different clubs, different people could gather together and, you know, put whatever they wanted in these vitrines. And the airport's like, Jesus, it's like a huge logistical nightmare to try to get people to move their exhibits in and out. And yes, but, you know, it's important. It makes it the airport say something about Austin. So, in fact, they did that program. And to me, that's one of the coolest things in the entire airport is those little exhibit spaces. And the wackiest things come up there. I mean, there'll be one that is sheet music that is written by Austin musicians from an archive at Texas State University, where they have a significant, you know, music archive there. So you can see Willie Nelson's handwritten music that he composed for some song, or really, really kind of cool museum quality stuff that's exhibited there in a very public space, the airport. One of my all-time favorite things in there was one time they had church lady hats. And it was all of these women, African-American women in churches in East Austin that had really incredible church hats that they wore with like feathers and bright colors and beads. But it was a little bit of local culture of that neighborhood that is a real authentic part of Austin. And if you don't have, if that's not built into the architecture, there's not the ability of the community to express itself in a place like its airport. There also are many things here about other aspects of Austin. So on the right, the whole building's almost like Tinker Toys put together. There is this logic, there's a kind of rationality of the airport. And Austin's this very educated community where we overthink everything in Austin. And the airport needs to be this kind of logical, rational, intellectual kind of place. And it is. It also uses local materials substantially. So all the granite in the airport is Texas pink granite, comes from just 50 or 60 miles away from here. And again, has meaning. It localizes the airport to this region of the country. And then there are some specific things done with that granite. So there's the local Texas pink granite on the right. And on the left are these glyphs that are built into the baggage claim area in the airport. Making a glyph is a very, it comes from roots in Native Americans in Mexico and in the desert Southwest. They often carve these glyphs as that's part of their alphabet or their communication. So here the glyphs are of different seeds and different leaves of trees in central Texas. And again, a craftsman named Philippe Kleinfelter carved these things, which are actually 3 feet by 6 feet. They're huge and they're beautifully carved. And they have images of these different trees of central Texas. And it is exactly the same trees that the streets of Austin, the east-west streets, as I mentioned in an earlier lecture, were all named for the trees of Texas. So you get peach, and you get bodark, and you get live oak, and those are exactly the trees that are represented in those glyphs. And then on the floor of the baggage claim area, then you see this mural in the terrazzo that shows the plan, the original 1839 Waller plan of Austin. And then it shows the names of those trees, and then there's a little brochure that tells you, yeah, the names of the trees, or the trees, or the glyphs. And then there's another mural right next to it in the terrazzo that talks about the rivers of Texas, and it shows you all of the rivers of Texas, and they're labeled, and likewise, then the north-south streets in the plan of Austin were named for the rivers of Texas. So that whole history of the geography and the names of the streets and the trees and the rivers, all of that's embedded in the architecture of the building as well. Again, trying to say this is not generic airport, this is Austin's airport, and trying to make a connection between a sense of place and meaning and this building. So the point here is to really make a building that responds to human factors. It's not enough to do one of these things. They all need to be done and then kind of woven into each other. And the bottom line of this airport is that it really is embraced by the citizenry of Austin. There are national aviation groups that rate all the airports in the United States and actually all the airports in the world. And every single poll since the building was opened 16 years ago has ranked the Austin airport in the top five in the country in terms of satisfaction. People just like this airport. Now, they don't just like this airport by accident. This is something you design into an airport. If you want to make people like it, enjoy it, embrace it, then you have to build in those design values. You have to do it in a way that is respectful of those human factors in the building. And as a result, the Austin airport's been super successful. They're now, as I said, adding on to it, and the officials at the airport are basically just saying, man, we just got to not screw it up. How can we do the next stage of it and not diminish the success we've had in that airport? Okay, a second building. We're going to look at two libraries here. We looked at libraries when we were talking about designation and organization of use, and they were very different from each other. These are two completely different libraries as well. But let's think now sort of conclusively about all of these human factors and how can they be used to enrich a function like a library. In this case, this is a library at the University of Delft in Holland. And the architects are Mekanu, really cool kind of cheeky, badass firm in Holland. Very collaborative firm, kind of group design firm, and very into human factors as generators of architecture. So it's an interesting situation in that they needed a new big library at the University of Delft, but they kind of had the campus was full, and about the only place they could find to do it was an open space in the center of campus. But this open space was very, very precious. People liked that open space. There were activities that happened on that open space, so they hated to take that good outdoor space and put a building there, and yet that was about the only place they had that would accommodate this central function of the library. So the solution was to actually keep the open space and the building. So as you can see in the slide on the right, the grass just goes up over the building, and the building is tucked under it, and you haven't reduced the amount of open space at all, and yet you accommodated a very large building underneath it. So there's actually a three-story building there, and that three-story building has kind of got a U-shape of rooms that look out, and then in the center of it is the big reading room of the library, and over that center is this big conical shape. And one of the things that was interesting about this from the very beginning was they took an attitude of making this a mixed-use library. So there is a huge computer center in the library. There are lots of faculty offices, like over 100 faculty offices are in the library. There's, of course, the normal library functions of books and reading rooms and study areas and so on. But instead of making a separate normal library function, they integrated it with this computer center and integrated it with a substantial number of faculty offices. So around the outside, one wing of it is all computer center. Two other wings are faculty offices as they look to the outside. And those have, of course, big windows and look into beautiful trees and natural surroundings. Then in the center of it is this big reading room with this huge skylight that comes down in the center of it. And you can look through the faculty offices we're seeing in the slide on the left, and you're getting the borrowed light that comes from the exterior through the offices and then into the reading room. And you see the stair that takes you up to those faculty offices. But think for a minute about just by this designation and organization of uses, by how you put what function. They have completely transformed the relationship between students and faculty. Now, if I'm a faculty member, I am constantly, to go to my office, I freaking go through the middle of the library. So any students that are studying there in the library, I have the opportunity for casual encounter with them, just coming and going to the library. Likewise, if I'm a student and I'm kind of stuck on something and I realize my faculty member's got his office right there, I could just go over and ask that question. And it makes a completely different relationship between students and faculty than exists at most universities. And in fact, it's created this real different sense of community there. So the designation and organization of uses, the putting together of these activities in a quite an unusual way, and the way they are arranged with each other, has then created a kind of architectural determinism that has engendered a completely different relationship between faculty and students, and a sense of community between them. If you're the kind of faculty member that likes to hole up in your office and never have anything to do with students, this is not the place for you. This does not happen here. If you're the kind of faculty member that loves engagement with students, then this is a fantastic place to be. If you're the kind of student that wants anonymity, I don't even want to run into those bastards walking across campus, you know? They can stay to themselves, and I'm staying to myself. Then this is not the place for you. But if, in fact, you'd like to get to know faculty members, you'd like to engage with them, you'd like mentorship, then this is a place that really encourages that to happen. And it really does happen at University of Delft in a way it doesn't in most universities. So, very strong sense of organization, designation of uses, very strong determinism of behavior that happens there. There also are very strong dealings with these notions of humanism, both humanism in terms of just making a warm, interesting, personal space to the building. The books being everywhere is a way of just warming up the whole thing. None of these little rabbit warren book stack areas that are creepy. Everything's very open, very brightly lit. From those book stacks, you can very conveniently walk across these little bridges and get into these beautiful reading rooms on the inside. So you can get really quiet space. You can get much more lively space. Lots of different alternatives of scales and kinds of places to study or to access the books. Very strong attention to the very most personal scale of the building. So in the computer center over here, they slanted all of the desks so you look out the window to these big trees that are right out there. And that's fantastic. I mean, instead of being in some, I don't know, internal basement-like space and glued to a computer screen, which is just freaking creepy, just makes you nerdy and stupid after a while. Instead, you know, the desks are angled, so the minute I look up from my computer, I see the sky, I see the birds, I see the trees, I see the outdoors, and there's just that kind of refreshment to your brain. But of course, there's the glare that might come on your screen with all that natural light. Maybe that's why they put these things in basements lots of times. But in fact, they've got these nice little screens right there that block the glare on the computer screen so that you can see out and see the natural light, but you don't get the glare that would spoil the ability to see your computer screen. Just simple little devices. Slides on the left, I mean, just the way they display all of the periodicals. They're enticing. You can see them. They're visible, instead of being stacked up in some corner somewhere and you're not tempted to go look at that. Other little details on it, the handrail on the stair altogether. I mean, the stair is made out of wood. If that, say, had been made out of metal and somebody goes clomping up the stairs, bang, 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 and it's just not a pleasant sound and it's supposed to be a library, it's not very quiet. Instead, the wood is thick enough and it kind of absorbs the sound. It makes it a little duller. The wood is also nice to look at, a little warmer. Same way with the handrail. Again, you need a sturdy stair. It's mostly metal. It's strong. It's sturdy. But then when you go to the part of the handrail where you actually touch, that's wood, more the temperature of your skin, and a little more warm and humane in that regard. So, at the personal scale, the humanism is very strong. Also at a larger scale. I mentioned this periodic natural relief that is all around the building, and it was in this big open space, and then preserving that green right on the roof of the building so that people can still have a picnic out there, lay on the grass, take some sun, run around with your dog. I mean, all those kinds of things can still happen in that green open space. And in fact, new things can happen. You can have a little concert there in the slope. It's where people can sit and see out to the performance at the lower level. So it actually has made a kind of amphitheater on the campus as well. And then there is definitely meaning that's given to this building. That conical shape definitely has become an icon for the campus. In fact, a lot of times you see that as just an emblem of the University of Delft. It certainly lets people know where the library is, where this very central function is. When you get inside, that becomes a kind of major, strong element of form inside the building. So it's associated a kind of meaning with the centrality of the library on the campus and this function as the central part of the campus. Okay, completely different kind of library. This library is for a kind of not very affluent neighborhood in London. So London's a big city. It's by and large a rich city. But there definitely are parts of London that are pretty poor neighborhoods. And they have a big library system, lots of branch libraries. And one of the things they're having a problem with in London was in these poor neighborhoods, they put a little branch library in there, but nobody was using the library. And they wanted, this is probably where they needed the library services the best, in these neighborhoods full of disadvantaged kids. So they wanted to be able to bring those kids into the library more easily, make the library more appealing somehow to kids who it might not be so cool to be the kind of kid that hangs out in the branch library. So they hired an architect named David A.J. He's an African architect, and this is a neighborhood that was mostly African families. So he attended lots of meetings with the people in the neighborhood, tried to get to know them and understand them. And one of the things they figured out was in this neighborhood, there was one spot where all the kids liked to hang out, and it was kind of popular. And it was this place that was a market street. You see in the slide on the right, all these umbrellas and their market stalls. And this is not one of those really cute European markets with all the oranges perfectly lined up and all the bananas over here. It isn't a charming market. It's just a freaking market. And yeah, you can get food there, but it's probably boxes of crackers and stuff like that. It's not, glamorous food. And also, this is a place where you buy your socks, you buy your underwear, you buy pots and pans. It's an outdoor market. It's a market that just operates maybe 3 days a week, and they're just stalls on the street. But it's where you get everything. And this was the hangout place. This was a place where people, the kids in this neighborhood, like to hang out. And as you can see, in the market, they just like back up their truck and unload their stuff. And it's pretty scuzzy place, but cool. And so that's where they decided to put the library, on this street right next to the market. And the idea was that the library becomes an extension of the market. And they actually didn't call it a library. Instead, they called it an idea store. It's just like a store, like any other commercial outlet. And there's nothing scary about going into a store. There's nothing nerdy about going into a store. This is a store you would go into, and what you would purchase here or walk out with are ideas. So the building is not meant to look like a library. It's kind of meant to look like a store. So it's kind of got this commercial quality, the glass and the kind of bright colors in the glass. And then down on the street here, you just like go right into the library off the street on two levels, both at the ground level, you just bop right in there, and then there are escalators that take you up to the upper level to go in. And it's not very secure. You can just walk right in there and sit down at a computer and do your work without going through any kind of security. If you go in deeper in where the books are, then they have some security, but They made it just an extension of the sidewalk. And so you just go there and you buy your fruits and vegetables and your ideas and your books, and they're just all the same thing. Completely took all the nerdiness and the sort of intellectual or academic nature of a library. Screw it, forget it. And maybe in another part of town, you'd want to make the nobility of learning or the monumentality of the Western tradition somehow conveyed in the building. But here, what they're trying to convey is just, this is everyday stuff. Just go in here and sit on a computer and go, get on the internet and figure out whatever you need to figure out. That's what a library is about. That's what learning is about. And it turns out it's like super popular. So then inside they put cafe, food, coffee shop, stuff like that in it. There's not any rules about being quiet. You can be as noisy as you want to in that library. And you can have food anywhere. You don't have to just have it in the cafe. You can take your food anywhere in the library. They designated and organized uses in a much more interactive, ad hoc, informal way, just like the neighborhood did down in that market, and made the library more like the market in terms of its designation of uses. And then when you get on the upper floors of it, it actually has really cool views out to the rest of the city. There's little study spaces and really a whole lot of this is access to a computer, because a lot of people in the neighborhood don't have that. So it's a place where they can hook up and get online. And sometimes even watch TV programs, and they don't care. You can do anything you want to with that. Play video games, not a problem. But it just makes library into a completely different thing than it might have been otherwise. And it does it by the designation and organization of uses. It does it by architectural determinism, putting that stuff right here, tempting. You know, look, you can walk right in here. You can get on the internet. You can, you know, buy your weed over there and then come in and get on internet and whatever. It's just all the same thing. But that's architectural determinism. And it's really worked. It's completely changed the attitude of people in that neighborhood about a library. Okay. So that's how the confluence of these things can make a huge difference in that little neighborhood function. Okay, so now let's take this one step further. So if we can combine the designation and organization of uses with architectural determinism, with humanism at a smaller scale, with humanism at a larger scale, with communication and meaning in the building, then let's roll back and start pulling in some of the things from the rest of the semester. From the first one-third of the semester when we talked about form. Now, what if we said, okay, all those things about human factors, they're important, but we're still really, really conscious of form. And we want form to be just head and shoulders with everything else and equally important. How does that kind of chemistry find its way into a building? So this is the Stata Center at MIT by Frank Gehry, completed in 2003. And this is a building for computer science at UT. But they didn't just have computer science. They also mixed in, there's a little bit of linguistics department in here, and there's some of the psychology department in here, because MIT's got a new attitude that we don't make, you know, the history building and then the architecture building and then the mechanical engineering building. Instead, we start mixing those things up, because that's, again, architectural determinism. That's trying to get those faculty members in different disciplines to cross-fertilize their ideas. So right from the get-go, designation, organization of uses, yeah, we're going to have some psychology and some linguistics and some computer science, because the truth is computer science is a language. Linguistics is about language. Couldn't we have our linguistics people talking to our computer science people? What is the effect of all of this digital world that we're a part of on psychology? Should we, when we're thinking of how we set up programs and how we set up internet formats, should we be thinking about psychology? Why wouldn't we put the psychologist in the middle of the computer science people too? So there's some of that going on in the building. But if you're going to do that, would you really hire Frank Gehry to be your architect? I mean, Frank Gehry's like this badass big form guy, right? He crumples up paper and thinks it's a building. He's nuts. And he's all in the art scene, and he's always, you know, fraternizing with all these big-name artists in Los Angeles. And is this the guy? Well, that's what Mr. Stata came to the table, and he said, yes, Frank Gehry's the guy. He gave a ton of money, but he said, I'm only given this money if Frank Gehry will be the architect for the building. And I want it to be a powerful building in terms of form. I want it to be super creative, because I want these computer science people to be creative people. And how can you be in a dull, stupid environment and try to be a creative person? You need to be in a creative environment to do that. So he insisted, and this Mr. Stata, he graduated from UT in computer science, and then he made a ton of money, and now he's given a little bit of it back. But he's saying, in my success, creativity was huge. So it's very important that there's creativity in that environment. So yeah, there's big form in this building, and you get these wild, unusual architectural forms right there on Vassar Street in the middle of a very staid campus at MIT, and all this crazy stuff going on. But it's meant to say that this is what computer science is. Computer science is thinking outside the box. Computer science is thinking creatively. That's what it's about. And that's the message that's meant to be conveyed. So it's issues of form combined with these other issues we've been talking about. It certainly is about the designation and organization of uses, and it certainly is about how people work with each other. In fact, one of the charges that the provost gave to Frank Gehry when he first started the job was, I've been on an advisory committee at MIT for more than a decade, and the provost told me this at a dinner one night. I'm sitting next to the provost, and he said, you're an architect. I want to tell you some stories about architects. Number one, on this building, the Stata Center, we charged Frank Gehry with, I didn't care what it looked like. Honestly, I'm a provost. I care how it behaves. I care what kind of work gets done in this building, because my success as a provost of this university is measured on how productive my faculty members are. I'm interested in that building making them more productive. So I told that badass Frank Gehry, this is what's important in this building. I want you to get all those nerds out of their offices and interacting with each other. I do not want people in silos. I don't want them, in their tiny little groups and never talking to anybody else. I want cross-fertilization of ideas, because that makes people more productive. So he said, I gave that charge to Frank Gehry. I gave that charge to every architect that was building on the campus at the time. And there were two other big buildings being done at the same time. One of them was a brain and cognitive science building that's right across the street from this, also done by a big name architect. And he said, I told that architect exactly the same thing. But the provost is telling me, in the case of the Stata Center, Frank Gehry freaking did it. He did it. He got those nerds out of their offices, and people in this building really do interact with each other. Across the street in brain and cognitive science, those people never talk to each other. They're all holed up in their silos. There's no interaction. There's much less cross-fertilization of ideas. As far as I'm concerned as the provost, it's a freaking failure, that building. Now, I charged the architects the same way in both cases. Frank Gehry, of all people, listened to me and actually made this building do what we needed it to do. So one of the ways it does it is it weaves all the way through the building this kind of street at the lower level, this long, thin, interactive area. It interfaces that with exterior spaces like this amphitheater and other outdoor places for gathering, obviously not in the wintertime when it's snowy like this, but in the nice parts of the year, places to spill out and have a cafe or have a gathering or have a class. Very many public spaces for interactive activity. He made the building actually talk about what it does. So that bright yellow form there is this really important conference room. This is the idea conference room. This is a place where everybody comes together and has big discussions. And it's a very, there's an identity to it, and there's meant to be a role for it. And it's got a very distinctive form that goes with that function. And that's true in all parts of the building. These are not just arbitrary shapey forms. When you actually drill down, each of them is a room that has a particular kind of identity and function that goes with that. And then they're all glued together by this public space that runs through. That's the entry on the left right there. As you wander through this space, it's got beautiful natural light that comes through. There's art and exhibit stuff on the walls of it. You see these nerdy faculty members right here. They're having their coffee. But right by them is this enormous blackboard. And that blackboard, I've seen that with all kinds of formulas scratched on it. So these guys, they're not doing it now. They're not performing very well. But, you might sit there and have your coffee, and a thought comes to you, and you scratch it on the blackboard, and somebody else comes up and says, no, actually, I think blah, 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 blah. And then you have a discussion, and you have that cross-fertilization of ideas. So putting that blackboard there is a provocation for some kind of interaction. But in addition, there's all kinds of other things, just little informal places for people to socialize, to get to know each other, to run into somebody else. Lots of little nooks and crannies and corners, lots of little informal seating spaces. There's a branch library along there where you can browse around for a book or check in or check out a book from the larger MIT library. There's a fitness and recreation place, which actually is an older building that pre-existed on the site. And instead of tearing down the older building, which was a gym, they just left it and surrounded it by the rest of the building and opened up to it. So the gym is still sitting there, operating as a gym, right in the middle, right on this street that goes through. So you can see, Joe Blow nerd in his lily white skin and too tight gym shorts and, it's right there. And that's meant to make people interact, see each other, in a way that doesn't normally happen in an academic building. A much more mixed-use building with fitness and with library and with coffee places, tons of food stuff, regular restaurant where you can sit down and have a nice lunch, a cafe where you can just buy something and breeze in and out, coffee shops, and all of those with places to sit and eat and interact around in the building. That was essential for breaking down these silos and making places where people interact. So that's on the lower level. From upper levels, you look down into that space, so way up to the third floor, you're still having a little communication down there. And then on the fourth floor, there's a second street that runs through the whole building, and that's where all the conference rooms and meeting areas and those kinds of spaces are in the building. So it's a little quieter interaction, but again, a real interactive space that runs through the building. And all of these spaces are interesting heights and interesting pathways and lots of good light, so they're pleasant places to be and people tend to hang out there. So that's kind of the ethos of it. Now imagine the difference between that and a normal academic building with lots and lots of double-loaded corridors. Just a hallway, lots of closed doors on either side. And how do you feel about your academic colleagues if you work in an environment like that versus how do you feel about your academic colleagues if you work in an environment like that? And you can look up and see, a few people in a conference room up there at the top right. Look down and see a robotics lab down there on the left. But just as you're going through the building, what's happening there reveals itself to you. You know if somebody's got a new robotics experiment going on because you can see down into their lab where that happens. You know if there's a high-level discussion of whether so-and-so is going to get tenure or not because it's freaking happening right there, and you can see. Everything that happens in the building becomes open and transparent and interactive. And there are some people who choose to hole up still, as in the slide on the left, some faculty member's office. But then there are other people, like in the slide on the right, that use the opportunity to express themselves, and they give meaning. Look at the trips I took last summer. Look at my kids. Look at my, grandma's farm in New Hampshire. I mean, it's just all kinds of things are just, people have the opportunity to reveal themselves, and the building has that ethos, and they do it. Right after this building was finished, there was a guy who, there's some secure parts of the building because they're grants and, you know, things that have to happen there that are fairly secure. So there was a guy that showed me around in the whole building. He took me everywhere, top to bottom, all the way through the building, and gave me a great tour. And so that was like maybe 2.5-3 hours. And then, you know, I was just going down the elevator, saying goodbye to him. And there was a graduate student who was on the elevator with us, and he hears us, you know, discussing the building, and I'm thanking this guy for showing me around. And then we walk out of the elevator, and I say goodbye to him, and he walks off. And the graduate student hangs out, and he walks up to me, and he said, "You want to see my place?" And I said, "Yeah, I'd like to see your place." So he said, "Come back on the elevator." So he takes me up to, I don't know, the 5th floor or something, and he shows me his lab. And he loves his lab. My God, and this is a guy who probably not terribly socially adept. I know I'm kind of knocking nerds here, but I can do it. I am one. I'm an MIT guy myself, you know? And believe me, I know nerds. And this is a guy who's not socially adept. But he's got a community. He's got buddies. He's got friends because he works in this environment that has that sense of, this is a fun place. We're going to all have fun here. We're just going to. Lighten up. Loosen up. We're all going to get to know each other and we're going to have fun. And also, it's not a tidy place. You know, it's messy. People got messy desks. They got messy labs. It's okay. The building's messy. It all works together. And it really is quite an ensemble. So there was, right about 2002, right before this building opened, there was a retrospective on Frank Gehry's work in the Guggenheim Museum in New York. The entire Guggenheim Museum, which was designed by Frank Lloyd Wright, we looked at it earlier, the whole building was shut down, and they had all Frank Gehry. And you started at the bottom of that big spiral with Frank Gehry's early career, and you just went sequentially through all of his work as you went up in the building. And it was a very impressive exhibit. I mean, he does tons of models, so there were these incredible models to see. But the climax of the entire exhibit was a room at the top of the whole museum. And the entire room, which was probably, I don't know, 30 feet by 60 feet, a very big room. And it had no models and no drawings and no visual representation of a building. It just was the programming for the Stata Center. It was their decisions about how it worked functionally. It was all the diagrams, it was all the notes from the users, it was all the conversations, it was all the just making this building work functionally and in terms of human factors. And you could see the time and effort and energy they had put into making that work. And the other thing that was freaking phenomenal about Frank Gehry is this is his retrospective, this big, important art museum, honoring him with this exhibit. And what does he put at the very top? He puts human factors right there alongside all that badass form making. Just as important and just as integral to his buildings. So that is evident to me in the Stata Center. It really pulls together multiple things we've talked about through the semester. Okay, Twitter card question for today. And this is really preparing us to think, after the test on Tuesday, for the rest of the semester, to think synoptically about the semester. So I want you to think form, physical considerations, human factors. What for me is the most important of these? What for me is the thing that is most essential for architecture to do? Is it form? Is it physical considerations? Is it human factors? That's not saying the other two aren't important, but if you're placing personal priorities, would you prioritize form or physical considerations or human factors? And why does that seem important to you?